Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name is Jolyon Rubinstein.
My name is Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation. How you doing, Hayden?
I'm pretty good. How are you? How was your morning yoga?
It was great, man. Yeah. Dude, it was your birthday yesterday.
It was my birthday.
Hayden is 21 today. Yeah. And, you know, what do you hope to happen in your 21st year?
Just the same thing that happened in my 20th, really.
Yeah.
I'm just looking to continue as I started.
Fantastic.
You know, being my best self, life goals, inspiration.
Just kind of like, you know, hashtag just like blessed life and everything.
So this is News Roast and we're having another three courses of conversation. And today we've got someone in who I've known for a very long time. Very, very, very impressive journalist. Also extremely young and extremely successful.
So annoying.
At a very, very young age.
Yeah.
And I sometimes forget how long I've known you and how when you started doing what you do, you were like 16, 17 years old. And by the time you reached like 24, you were like killing it.
Yeah.
And were just very... Anyway, it's Billy J.D. Porter.
J.D. Porter. Who, over the moon. We've been trying to get...
Over the hill.
Over the hill. Well, she's over the hill.
We're not young anymore.
That's us. That's
but
us.
We have been trying to get Billy on for quite a while. I personally got to know during the sort of the heydays of BBC Three. Super impressive documentaries.
Amazing documentaries.
Channel 4 journalists doing some quite tear-jerky interviews occasionally.
Yeah.
Can I ask, when you did get into journalism, because you've always struck me as, you know, quite a fearless journalist, like you seem to ask questions that a lot of people I think would probably shy away from. Is that something you tried to develop or was that just quite natural, do you think, for you?
I think it was like taking poor advice at a young age and like kind of, I don't know, I guess it's weird to think of like when I first started doing stuff on camera, it was like early internet days.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I'm like, thank God, because loads of it is really like hard to find now. But like,
I sometimes think that as well about,
you know what I mean?
Shit, like, I did in 2007, like, thank God.
Yeah, but it kind of just felt like it didn't really need to worry about what you were asking or what you were doing. Just the fact that it was going to be like on the internet
was enough.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I just used to be like a huge asshole to people. That was like the thing that I did. It was just like
you
easy.
Were really good at it. It was a USP. I remember you used to write do's and don'ts, and I remember I used to speak to people that you'd written a do's and don't about, and they were like broken.
Oh,
it was quite. But it was brilliant to read because it was really funny.
The first thing that I ever wrote when I was at Vice was actually like an article that said everyone who works at Vice looks like something from the don't section. Because I got in there and I was like, what the fuck? Like, these are the people who are kind of hunched over their computers, like trolling the world.
It's interesting with Billy because to a lot of people that are thinking about getting into journalism, you went straight from school straight into work, basically. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you'd planned or was it just worked out like that? Because it didn't...
No, not, I mean, like, I was about to enroll in sixth form and then a few days... I had like a weird kind of home situation with my parents and I kind of just last minute ended up not doing that and working for a PR person who was based in the Vice office.
Mm.
So I guess it was like...
But it's interesting because it worked out for you, didn't it? And a lot of people... I don't know. Sometimes you think to yourself, why are you going to uni for 3 years to talk about philosophy when you could get straight into doing stuff that you enjoy doing?
If you haven't followed Billy's stuff, she has written for NME, Dazed and Confused, ID Magazine, Vice, The Guardian, and now, you know, you're doing an awful lot of stuff with Channel 4, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that, I don't know, do people go to university purely for careers purposes? Like, anyway, I don't think so. I think it's just so that you can, like, go to...
Talk about philosophy.
Well, I don't know. It's
you
like 3 years to figure it out and like get wasted, isn't it? I guess.
Do you like the idea of going to university? Is it something you can imagine still doing at some point?
Well, yeah, maybe. It's like a kind of like awkward, weird, mature student.
I just think you could just get an honorary degree in a couple of years. Just get your title from the Queen and then you'll get your honorary degree from somewhere.
Right, okay.
And then you don't have to do 3 years. It's fine.
But I think I'd rather go there for the experience than the like piece of paper at the end.
You'd be like a 35-year-old sort of
fresh
hanging out
week.
With all the freshers.
Yeah.
So Billy, what have you brought us for our metaphorical starter?
I'm just wondering if I should rejig the courses now so that
go
they
for
kind
it.
Of like go more in the
a bit meze.
Yeah.
A bit tapas.
Yeah.
We could bring them all at once. Yeah, fuck it. We could get
our juices,
our metaphorical juices.
So I guess something I've been thinking about recently is how and I feel like I should word this carefully, but how, I guess, the idea of, like, I'm loathed to use this word, but wokeness has become like a bit of a trend almost, that's being kind of like hijacked by big brands and corporations who I don't actually believe share the values that they claim to.
So where have you seen this? What kind of example?
Well, I mean, I guess in a like broad sense, it's the fact that you can go and buy a t-shirt that says girl power or feminist from Primark that was made by like a 9-year-old in a sweatshop, most probably. But I guess more recently I've been thinking about whether or not the Me Too movement is in danger of that as well.
Oh, right.
I believe that in terms of like, if you had a line graph of progress, everything is obviously moving in a really positive direction. And I think that it's such a crucial time right now for like, yeah, it's like a moment of reckoning, and I think it's like a necessary purge on society almost, where we should all kind of assess power imbalances in every area between men and women. But I don't know, like one thing that I've been thinking about is the fact that Citizen Rose McGowan's docuseries is on E.
Yeah.
Which is a channel that, like,
Ryan Seacrest, champion of the working women.
Yeah, or, you know, kind of up until, I don't know when they cancelled that show, but they had Fashion Police for years, which was basically just kind of dissecting a woman's outfit and what she should and shouldn't wear. And I remember I did, like, a weird parody of that advice, which was called Who Looks Shitter?
I totally agree. I sort of think, I mean, just on the Ryan Seacrest thing, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago at the Oscars, they had, like, because they're always, you know, branded with, you know, Swarovski or whatever.
Yeah.
And they had kind of like Diamond Cam, and they were kind of like, had people on specifically who are branded, had a micro sort of like super close-up camera so they could kind of put in their diamond ring. And it was all basically about, you know, the commercialization of the products that were hanging off these human props, rather than like, oh my God, you got nominated for Best Actress. That's incredible. And then I suppose sort of taking it back to what you were saying earlier about brands, like I guess the most famous example recently is Kendall Jenner, right? And the Pepsi advert.
Yeah. But I mean, that was kind of more, oh God, yeah, it's sending shivers down my spine. Definitely. That's definitely what I'm talking about. But I guess more recently, and I don't want to kind of enter into a very long debate about it for various reasons, but things like Vice magazine recently kind of doing various things that would kind of have you believe that they're allies of the Me Too movement, which I don't really think is. I think that tonally it's very off, considering stuff that they've printed in the past and considering what's currently going on at the company.
We were talking about this with Dame Baptiste a little bit, and my feeling is that people have this outrage about these things, and then these companies, these huge multinationals, fire someone, not because they have the same moral outrage, but because they don't want their bottom line to be affected. It's like a commercial decision to fire someone. Like, the reason, I would presume, maybe you can't say this, but the reason Vice took that attitude to this movement at this point is because, you know, they have this investment from Murdoch. They want to sell out ultimately. They want to cash in eventually and retire. And you can't do that if
I don't really get that link, because I doubt that they're doing kind of weird branded buses at like the Women's March in order to appease Murdoch. But yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that they were like, they had a really strong brand presence, which I think just the idea of that is a bit strange as well. Like, Women's March in New York and LA, and they were handing out tote bags and like badges that say "Women don't forget," like in the midst of a quite widespread sexual abuse investigation, which I don't want to go into, but like,
Tagging themselves to the movement in order to...
Yeah, and I think that's dangerous. And it's like, it's become a topic that people, I guess journalists, it's easy now to have, okay, this person's now weighing in on the Me Too movement. And it's such a gravely important issue that I feel is kind of being cheapened and trivialised by the fact that people can sell stuff off it.
But has it always been like this? I mean, kind of, has it ever been thus? You know, I mean, I think that back in the day, you know, anti-Vietnam protests, you know, record labels used to go down and give out kind of singles to try and genuinely make these people trendsetters. And then during the Iraq War, there was a huge Iraq demonstrations. Diesel did quite a famous campaign where they kind of, you know, had really sort of just taken on protesters, kind of a fashion label. So has it ever kind of been thus? Is it more about kind of a youth movement and being able to kind of capitalize on that rather than the specific issue itself? Not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but is this kind of just brands piggybacking for a financial end?
Maybe it is, but I feel like, I don't know, we are at a point where lots of things are changing, like diversity and visibility is at the forefront of every kind of industry right now, and people are realizing that they have to change both behind the scenes and in a kind of like publicly facing sense. So in fashion, for example, but in my mind, like the body positivity movement has kind of gone full circle, because it's like, yes, it's brilliant that like you're seeing lots of different shaped bodies and that there are like curve lines being added to brands that historically I guess didn't cater to people of all sizes, but now I feel like there is this real reaffirmed idea that your worth is still based on what you look like, full stop. Like you can still have confidence if you look this way, but yeah, like what you look like it's just like rammed down your throat. And then it's also like, you know, these campaigns that supposedly are to make women feel less ashamed of themselves, like I bet, you know, it's not like any of them are kind of giving money to a bullying charity or to whatever. I don't know. I mean, it's not something that I have like a really, really like hard line viewpoint on, but I think it's something that's been on my mind recently because I just think that it's such a dangerous thing for like, I don't know. Once it was sex sells, now it's like activism sells.
Yeah, totally.
You're right in saying that it has been around for a while. I remember when I went down to the G8 protests years ago. I don't know if you're with me, but we bumped into a friend of ours that worked in marketing.
Right.
Yeah, and he's the type of guy that would have been at the G8 protests at all. And we're like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, we're just down here looking at people's trends.
Yeah.
To see who we can market our clients to. And
taking some pics for a mood board.
Basically. And then we sort of lolled at it. But now I feel like it's more important now. And the reason I feel that is because we went to Davos recently. And, you know, you have sort of not probably 99.9% of the world's wealth concentrated in this tiny town for like a week. If you wiped it off the map, all the money in the world would just be gone. It's like everyone's there. There's snipers on the roofs. There's a huge sort of, you know, barbed wire fence you can't get past.
Absolutely lovely. Private the free jets coffee at the, is excellent. At the airport.
And every session, every round table, every speech is about equality. And you're like, what the fuck is going on here? All the politicians that could change stuff are here. All the people with the money that could actually change stuff are here. And still nothing has changed. But like, these people would love to talk about all these different sort of culturally progressive movements. It was their thing, whether it was, you know, Me Too or whether it was, you know, Black Lives Matter or whatever it was. These people were like fully into all these things. And Trump turned up, and it's the first time he's ever been to Davos. And people there that are the richest people in the world loved to be perceived as radical by like tutting about Trump being there. Like Trump was their bête noire. It was like they could seem as if they were sort of the defenders of the faith and social, you know, social justice causes because Trump was the enemy. But like, I feel like those people caused Trump. Like all the people that have been forgotten in America, all the sort of like, you know, however you feel about them, the white working class people from the states that nobody cares about anymore, voted for Trump in many ways because of this lip service that people like, you know, the people that went to Davos pay to these social justice causes without actually dealing with big fundamental economic problems in society, like making sure people have got jobs and making sure, you know, things are a bit more even and just, I don't know if I'm making any sense. Does that make sense?
I think it did at some point, but I zoned out along the way.
I think within Hayden's sort of like monologue about Davos, what he was trying to say partly is that really, is protest really ever going to turn into policy change? You know, like,
Yes, it will. I mean, but that's not what I've been debating in my mind. It's more about kind of like, is it a dangerous thing for young people to grow up and see that like caring about stuff is just something to be fashionable?
Yeah.
Because like fashions, you know, intrinsically come in and out. And so I don't think that like giving a shit should be something that lasts like a season, like autumn, winter, whatever. This is when I care about refugees, or this is when I care about this issue. But another thing that I was thinking was that I guess like in the age of social media, people have more of a platform to like pose as people who care about things, or even if they do, I don't know. I was also remembering this like a great reference. Do you remember this like Friends episode where they're all kind of like really like philosophizing about whether or not there's anything whether a true charitable act exists,
right?
A true selfless act, or do you do it to make yourself feel better about your privilege?
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, like, by today's standards, it's even worse, because it's like you don't just do that to make yourself feel better. You make it, you do it to make yourself look better.
Yeah,
or a
totally.
Lot of people do. And I think that while it's amazing that so many young people want to get involved in certain issues, like, there is obviously this awful trend of, like, the white savior and, like, you know, how many lives have we saved today? And this real hero complex from people who have done, I mean, I don't know.
That's what I'm trying to say. Like, I think, like, Vice going down with a bus, like, you're kind of speaking to the audience that was already converted anyway, and you're kind of also entrenching the opinion of the people that are, you know, voting for regressive things like Trump. You know, they look at that stuff and it makes them hate this kind of, like, you know, woke global metropolitan elite even more when they see that stuff, doesn't it? Does it? Is it, you know?
That's not an aspect of it that I've overly thought about. I just think it's interesting that there's, like, manpower and strategy behind their marketing department when it comes to women's rights, but not the same kind of care shown to their female employees. Like,
so given the fact that this is something you've sort of been contemplating and meditating on, like, what do you think a positive way to move this sort of dialogue forward is? Do you think this stuff needs to kind of be a bit more transparent and come out in the mainstream? Does there need to be a debate about brands kind of taking on this, you know, very serious issue about having equality in the workplace?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I believe that it's all a really, really positive step. Like, there's, like, a new McCain oven chips advert. Have you seen this?
No.
It came out, like, 2 days ago. And it's, like, a LGBTQI kind of... I think it's, like, a love wins type thing. And obviously, like, there's been a huge backlash against
Seems like
it.
An obvious thing to do, McCain's oven chips.
Well,
and
but here's the thing, like, I think that, basically, Jolyon, what I'm saying is I don't have a stance on it either way. I'm
right.
just, like, thinking aloud, but maybe McCain are doing it just to sell more chips.
Mm.
But
sure.
then isn't it positive to have, you know, more diverse people in your chip adverts anyway? Mm.
Yeah, I actually think it does. I mean, just not being funny about this, but, you know, the furore over Black Panther is another good example of just representation.
Yeah.
You know, people feeling that they're actually, like, black superheroes is incredible. You know, when Star Wars did Rogue One, you know, there was a huge, huge Twitter storm about people from sort of every colour and creed being like, we're actually represented for the first time all as heroes, the gamut, the whole colour scheme of human beings actually being presented in a way where it's not just the white guys that are the goodies. And I think it does have a hugely positive impact because, you know, it's so easy to sort of forget, but, like, you know, I've got... I got a goddaughter who's just turned 3 a little while ago. When she was 2.5, she was looking at Trump's sort of stuff on TV and going, that man is really angry. And it really got to me because I was like, God, at 2.5, you're really taking this in. And of course they are. I mean, kids have spent more time with screens now than they ever had. So, yeah, I think it's super positive, as long as we're not naive enough to think that sort of that sort of superficial kind of treatment of what sells in an advert is really replacing.
Yeah.
I think this is the key point, is when good, because, you know, obviously we're recording this, you know, the week of the BAFTAs, and, you know, there was an awful lot of work that was done with the Time's Up movement there and people storming the red carpet. And I think this PR, the only danger is that it doesn't actually convert to any policy changes. You know, how do you think we can go about actually pressuring government to actually change policy?
I think that stuff like that is positive publicity, because the Sisters Uncut stunt, I guess, wasn't there. That's different to what I'm talking about. It's not them kind of going there being like, buy our product.
No, obviously.
From our, like, you know,
I recognize
deeply unethical, whatever.
McCain's didn't pay for that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. But I don't know. I mean, I don't have any faith in this government, but I believe that people coming together and kind of shining a light on these issues is positive regardless. And I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Jolyon? Do you think...
What was your experience from your Brexit campaign? Because you launched the big protest, anti-Brexit protest after the vote. You were quite vocal about that.
Yeah.
Did that make you feel empowered or completely powerless afterwards?
Well, I mean, I think a mixture of both. But I did a project afterwards, sort of touring the country, speaking to young people about their feelings on politics and whether or not they feel part of the conversation. And I think that this word that's thrown around all the time of, like, like apathy. Like, I don't think that young people are apathetic or disengaged. I think that they're just not listened to, and they've been failed by politics for years in this country. So why would they necessarily feel like they can make a change? But I think that things are changing. I mean, it's just like, look at what's happened all over the world, like, since... Anyway, I'm not going to talk about anything to do with America because I want to move there, and I've got a visa in processing.
She's got a visa application pending.
Bless that old Donald Trump. So listen, that was a pretty meaty starter.
Pretty meaty, meandering, convoluted starter.
I mean, it was more like a huge sort of smorgasbord of tapas of issues. Which
charcuterie
was,
board.
Indeed.
Do you normally end with like a definitive stance for each thing?
No, I don't think we'll ever be able to work anything out definitively on a podcast.
I guess it's more just like, watch out for, like, it's brilliant that all of these issues are coming to the surface and then it's making you think, but is it making you think and then like want to go and buy a Pepsi? Because if so, they've won.
Billy.
Yes.
What have you brought us for your main course?
My main course is me boasting about my last project, which was a four-part documentary series for Channel 4 called Sound and Vision.
Yes. Produced by you. Executive produced by
you.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I watched it this morning, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I did a bit of research. I saw your your Mickey Blanco documentary, which was great.
Tell us about this series, if people haven't seen it.
So it's a... documentary series which focuses on different artists or music scenes which are having like an impact on culture or society beyond just kind of the music they make. So we did one episode with Mickey Blanco, which Hayden mentioned, which was about visibility of queer communities of color in Trump's America. So we went on tour with Mickey in Atlanta and North Carolina to speak about the importance of visibility and different laws that leave trans communities, especially those of colour, at risk.
Wow. There.
Such as?
So there aren't any laws against hate crime in Atlanta.
Are there not?
No.
Goodness. Wow. That must have been quite a journey.
And is there a lot of violence against the trans community in Atlanta? Is that,
yeah, I mean, there's a very, very urgent problem with violence against the trans community all over the world, but especially in that area, because obviously it's a, you know, more conservative heartland of America, but there is still a really, really brilliant, thriving scene. And I think that, like, the main takeaway that we all got after the film is that the scene is thriving, not in spite of, but kind of because of Trump, I believe, that they kind of, there's a sense of feeling re-energized and like, no, I'll shout 10 times as loud.
Totally.
And also it was just kind of a real education for me in terms of, you know, exploring ideas about gender and meeting people who don't identify as a binary gender. It felt like I'd never been in a situation where I'd been asking about what people's pronouns were, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I think that beyond just the project, it's actually been a really kind of like vital and inspiring learning curve about the way that I perceive gender and like the way I look at people and the world.
I think it's really challenging as well. I was filming, I think, a couple of years ago at Miss Transgender UK.
Right.
And one of the first things that the adjudicators spoke about was just that it was a huge triumph for them to even be there. And it was really quite shocking to me because I'd never really actually really thought about sort of the inherent difficulties of sort of making that choice and everything like that. And exactly like you're talking about, that reality of starting to educate myself about the sort of pronouns and everything like that. And just for a lot of the audience maybe who maybe have absolutely have never had engagement with this issue before, can you sort of elaborate a little bit about what that kind of journey was for you, sort of like what those pronouns that you were using became?
So I mean, we were filming with this amazing band in North Carolina called The Muslims, and they're like an all queer punk band.
Wow.
And the lead singer Layla was raising a child with her partner as, I guess, gender non-conforming is the right term. But so the pronouns that they use for their child is they, them, their, not gendered as male or female. And that's a choice that they want to leave to the child to make themselves if they feel like they want to align themselves with one over the other. And I think that the idea of misgendering a person isn't something that's ever kind of entered my mind. And so I think it's so important that we all educate ourselves on that and make sure that it's something that is a topic that's more in the mainstream and that people are more aware of.
Yeah. Just makes it so much less awkward as well. Like, I've been in scenarios in offices where somebody has been transitioning, perhaps, and people haven't known how to refer to them. And then if these conversations aren't happening in this public kind of sphere, then people just don't know how to deal with them. But if it's just something that you just take for granted because you've heard about it on a documentary like yours, perhaps, it just becomes a bit more normal. It's like, oh, okay, fine, like, what's the, you know...
Still quite taboo,
pronoun?
Isn't it?
A lot of the time, even if people have no prejudice whatsoever, if they have no experience of this sort of stuff, perhaps they haven't seen a documentary like yours, they just don't know where to go, or they feel awkward, or they don't want to offend someone, and then... But, you know, it's good to have that conversation in the, you know...
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if it's taboo. I hope it's not taboo.
I think outside of sort of like the M25, a conversation like this would be difficult for a lot of people to even have. And I think one of the dangers about the liberal bubble, if you like, is to kind of take for granted that although there are genuinely groups of people who are making sort of striving efforts to sort of broaden a dialogue, a lot of other people are looking to decrease that dialogue. In a way, I mean, did you actually witness a lot of aggression? Sort of, you talk about moving through Trump's America, or was it more you're sort of encased within people who are really sort of progressive and...
Well, so we were working with one network who were preparing for a demonstration, and this was a demonstration to shine a light on the problem of violence. You know, there were, I can't remember how many, but a really kind of horrifying number of deaths that had happened in Atlanta from violence against black trans women before we'd arrived. So, of course, there are some people who do have prejudices, but I think it's also... There are various things that put the trans community at risk, not just them being trans, you know. It's a kind of deep, deep systemic problem. Yeah, so that was episode one.
Yeah.
And then the second one was about like female grime artists and female UK rap artists, but also about the government cuts in the UK to youth spaces, where historically that's where grime was born, and where young people had access to various bits of equipment and met in order to collaborate. And those youth clubs are dying out all over London. So we went and did some work with this charity called Spotlight in Tower Hamlets. And since they've been open, there's been a huge decrease in local antisocial behaviour. I hate that term.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. Lots of people in the community completely believe, and it was my... you know, understanding from being there as well, that that facility being open has genuinely saved young people's lives and given them a huge, huge start and a place where they can feel safe and inspired. And obviously all of those places are completely at risk all the time.
Yeah.
And it's very scary to think that we're kind of like moving towards a time where that there won't be any.
So depressing.
Yeah.
So depressing.
But it's also, you know, I think it's about making the case much more vehemently. You know, we did, when we were doing our last TV show, we worked a lot with the Nottingham Workshop, which has sort of brought some incredible actors out, most notably people like Joe Dempsey, who's Gendry in Game of Thrones. And, you know, he speaks absolutely passionately about how that space completely changed his life. And we work with some, not just sort of like people who changed their life for the better, just like incredibly talented people who would not have actually come into contact with an entire lifestyle based on creativity if it wasn't for those spaces. I think it is something that's, you know, desperately in danger in this country, isn't it?
Yeah. We did some work with Lady Leisha, and she really kind of like found her voice as an artist at a youth club in Birmingham that's now closed. We went to visit another one that still kind of operates, but to a lesser extent than when she used to go. Kind of, I think there are less youth sessions and it's not open all the time to young people. But she's opened her own initiative in Stratford, which isn't kind of like a permanent, like, open every day
thing. That's amazing.
Yeah, so she's bringing in young girls to do music with her. I think that it's something that's been very rewarding for her to do, but she's doing it because she's scared that these spaces won't exist otherwise. And while it's amazing that artists are kind of taking the initiative and giving something back in that way, it's like we must be doing better. We must like be creating more places for those environments without
just places you can go where you don't have to spend money. You think about all the libraries that have closed, and I spent some time in a library the other day because I just didn't want to have to, you know, I wanted to sit in a space where I didn't have to buy anything and I could just be there and do some work. And that's, all those spaces are disappearing, and it's super depressing.
I mean, it's having a safe place to go after school.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I think that there's a really quite urgent issue there.
Especially in urban spaces. Like, I mean, a lot of the kind of, the sort of some people that I know who work in social care also were talking about kind of the absolutely vital need to have neutral spaces where postcode sort of warfare doesn't exist at
all.
Exactly,
yeah.
And you can actually kind of come and people can, with respect, sit with each other, admire each other, sort of watch each other work, and sort of you form an affinity there that would never happen.
Yeah.
You know?
100%. That was something that lots of the youth workers who help run Spotlight we're talking about as well.
Really?
It's a space where there is kind of no fighting, otherwise you won't be, you know, allowed in. And so it does completely kind of, it has so many benefits to the local community, both like inside and out.
It's so crazy as well at a time where sort of grime is sort of like literally becoming a, you know,
worldwide
force. And probably, you know, we're recording the week of the Brits, you know, all the grime artists will be, you know, hugely hailed as pioneers. And yet we're still kind of looking at that thing of the shutting down of the most basic sort of safety nets, really. I mean, what do you think, what can people do if they're concerned about this issue?
Well, I think that, you know, places that do exist, the few that are around, they're always looking for volunteers. I think that if you have anything that you can contribute to a space like that, be it, you know, a workshop or a special skill that you could help come in and speak to young people about, I'd say definitely contact your local youth services about doing something like that. And also, I guess it's just putting pressure on, you know, local councils to either save places that are not currently protected or that are at risk of closing, and just making noise about the need for more places to open.
Mm. Before we move on to your dessert, where can people watch it and remind people of what it's called?
They can watch it on 4OD. It's called Sound and Vision.
And it's a 4-episode series.
Yes.
That spans. So what are the other episodes, just quickly, the top line of the other two episodes?
Number 3 is about Vocaloid technology and a
Vocaloid?
What's virtual...
That? Is that like vocoding?
It's a Japanese like music program.
Oh, wow.
And it's about holographic virtual pop star called Hatsune Miku.
Wow, I've never even heard of that.
Yeah,
that sounds amazing.
By far the easiest artist to work with in the series, because she doesn't exist.
And then the fourth episode?
The fourth episode is about the rise of UK Afrobeats.
Billy, what have you brought us for your metaphorical dessert?
Metaphorical dessert is whether or not within our lifetime none of us will ever use cash.
Wow.
So there was this study that came out that said that by 2026, physical cash will only account for 21% of sales.
Wow.
In the UK.
I think this is happening. I'm into this. However, did you invest in Bitcoin?
No, but my friend who I was with yesterday said that he remembered that he had like 0.0. So like at the time, I think it had cost nothing, and now it's worth, he's got like 0.001 of a Bitcoin, and it's worth 800 quid or something.
What? Oh,
pretty
my
good.
God, it makes,
he's going to cash
sick.
It in. Cash
yeah,
it in
he
now.
Is.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about to collapse. So what? Do you think that's, I mean, is that a good thing? Is it a bad
thing? Well, I just think it's interesting about like the way that the value of money has changed. So I was thinking like the young people today get their pocket money like via PayPal or Venmo or
But
like,
you know what? I don't even buy this stuff. Like I know it's kind of, I heard this argument before, but it's like if there was a crash, there would be no legal tender whatsoever. Like, I don't think people are that, you know, all this talk about Russia going into the Atlantic and snipping the underseas fibre optics and stuff with subs. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of stuff, yeah. Like blacking us out. Like, I can't believe we'd just lose all our pennies and pounds, you know? What about the old 2p's and 5p's and 10p's? What would they just come back and suddenly be worth an absolute ton? I've got a lot of love as well for the old notes, yeah, you know, and the old coinage.
Well, we don't have enough notes, do we? There's much more money in our system than there are notes. You know, when you go to a cash machine and it says this cash machine's out of order,
yeah,
that doesn't mean the cash machine's out of order. It's that there's no cash in it,
yeah,
and that happens so regularly. But they won't put there is no cash in this cash machine because people would have a lack of faith in the system and be like, hold on a sec, the cash is running out, and
yeah,
everyone would
yeah,
freak.
Well. I started watching. Have you started watching that Netflix show, The Ozark?
Yeah, I've watched Ozarks. I loved it. Where are you at in it?
I'm literally finished the first episode. But that scene where he goes, I mean, spoiler alert, but where he goes into a bank and he wants to withdraw millions of dollars, and they're like, "You can't." Like,
so brilliant that.
You know, and he's like, "Well, you know, I could fucking go and wipe my ass with this money. It's none of your business." Like,
according
this
to modern
is my money,
money mechanics, you've got to have 20% of your net reserve and da da da. But it is quite deep. I mean, I think the first time I actually came into contact with any of this information, obviously, I'm a deep conspiracy theorist, was Zeitgeist 2, the movie. That well-known YouTube, completely, I mean, obviously very well-sourced. But isn't it that modern money mechanics states that a bank has to only hold 20%
even
of its net reserve?
Yeah.
Right, so basically they can have 20% of the cash and they just circulate whatever they want on it, right? Is that basically it? I mean, that's what Ozark messed with them on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, as you know, I left school at age 16 and I have no understanding of how like finance works whatsoever. But
I reckon you've got a pretty decent idea.
It's all, you know, from watching The Big Short. That's where my kind of understanding of the financial system comes from.
Well, if Margot Robbie's going to sort of like teach you maths in a bath full of champagne, like, I think that's a pretty good way to go, don't you?
But I mean, like, it's bizarre to me, the idea that, you know, money doesn't really exist. It's this kind of virtual symbolic thing that I don't know. It's weird that you're kind of like putting your money into someone else's hands like that.
The deep shit is like the stuff about how sort of the kind of, if you like, the sort of the conspiracy theory-esque stuff that I kind of think is quite cool, even if I know it's probably not true, was like in the 50s they decoupled the pound from the gold standard, which was when kind of physical value was completely disconnected. And a lot of people, quote unquote, lot of people, you just have to take my word for it, think that that was basically Britain's attempt to maintain control throughout the world, because global power had been lost to the Americans, and suddenly we were able to control money through our network of
offshore
tax havens,
the euro dollar,
which is one of Hayden's favorite. Nick Shackston's pretty good on that bad boy, isn't he? It's a great book called Treasure Island, which Hayden literally walked around with like it was his Bible for a good, I'd say, 3 years. It was a heavily thumbed book, wasn't it, Hayden?
It was heavily thumbed, yeah.
It's just weird, isn't it? You know, we're all so traceable via our transactions, and it's becoming near impossible to have any anonymity because everything, you know, people pay for everything on their cards. Yeah. Like when I was in Atlanta actually filming Sound and Vision, I went to that strip club, Magic City.
Of course you did.
Which is really famous.
Just for fun or just...
Just for fun.
Just for a laugh.
Gucci Mane was there.
Gucci? Really?
Great.
No.
Night. He was.
No way. Come
he was.
On.
100%.
For real?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't. But someone kept on saying, like, shout out Gucci. And I thought it was just because they were playing Gucci Mane. And then I was in the toilet and there are all these girls, like, being like, wow, have you seen Gucci? I was like, what, he's actually here? And I kind of turned around and, like, wafted away some weed smoke. Standard. And I was like, fuck, he's there. But I just remember thinking, like, fuck, I've never seen so much cash.
Really?
But it doesn't even feel like it felt kind of farcical because I was like, it doesn't.
It's true. How are you going to make it rain in strip clubs with Bitcoin? It's
exactly.
I actually bought, okay, it sounds a bit sad. I bought a money clip the other day. The reason I did it is because every time I have like, you know, 50, 60 quid in my pocket, I just lose a tenner here or a fiver there. I'm like, I need something to hold it all together. And you buy a money clip and you try and put your 60 quid in, it doesn't work. You need to have like 100 quid minimum for a money clip to work. So I'm never going to use it.
Maybe you can start your own line of money clips for like...
Thin money clips.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Do you know the most money I've ever seen in my life, right? Was I was filming in Colorado and it was just when weed had just been legalized.
Yeah.
And they're not allowed to use kind of PayPal or Visa or anything because federal law... It's weed still illegal.
Right.
So it's only within the States. So it was just cash. And I went into this vault and it was like just so crazy to me that this was all legal and there was literally a money iron.
Well, they've had to start their own banks in Colorado specifically for that reason. There are banks that only exist in Colorado because other states, you obviously can't send your weed money into another state because it's only legal in certain states.
Yeah.
So they have to have banks that only operate in states where weed is legal.
Let me just get back to this one point. There was a money iron, as in it had been invented to iron money.
Yeah.
Like, who invented that?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I know. I just iron my cash.
Otherwise, it does take up space. Wasn't that like, again, I'm fucking all of my knowledge about history is based on like Netflix. But if Narcos is completely factually accurate,
which it is,
wasn't Pablo Escobar had a huge thing about he didn't have enough room for the
cash.
For
his money, yeah. So he had to put it into like in walls and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, it's interesting. Great. I think this is going to fuck gangster movies as well, because you can't have those scenes with the cash counter. You can never bring a suitcase of something somewhere and leave it somewhere.
That's true.
Yeah.
So all of those scenes where that sort of stuff happens, gone.
They've just got to go to a really strange ATM in Shoreditch where you can get like,
well, there
special,
is this Bitcoin
like,
ATM. Yeah. Where is that? Have
it's
you
in
used
Dalston.
It? Right.
I don't have any Bitcoins to withdraw, unfortunately.
Where is it in Dalston? I'd like to go and try and...
I don't know. Google it.
Near but, somewhere they've made the new Nike advert.
But like, I don't know. We could make our own cryptocurrency, couldn't we?
Should we start our own?
What's your favourite named cryptocurrency? Mine is the Kanye.
Is there
does
a Kanye
that exist?
Yes, there's just a Kanye one, and it's just Kanye's face. Like, ew.
Fuck. I didn't. I don't know. I'm not up to date on my like blockchain knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not down with this. I mean, that, you know, talking about Davos again, there was so much stuff about cryptocurrencies there.
Yeah.
Like, anyone who thinks this is, like, an alternative kind of, like, you know, really kind of way to, like, mess with the man, like, those days have long gone.
Yeah.
Well, no, like, the guys... Okay, actually, the guys that were actually doing something for equality genuinely were the blockchain guys in Davos, because blockchain isn't just about currency, it's about creating a mechanism to give value to something.
Yeah.
Can you explain it to me? Because I genuinely don't understand.
It's literally just a sort of computer algorithm that is so complex and has to go through so many iterations that in doing so it creates value. It's like, right, how do you mine a piece of gold? You have to put a lot of effort and energy into getting that gold out, which then gives the gold its value.
Right.
It's the same but with an algorithm in a computer. So it's just a very complicated algorithm the computer has to go through in order to produce something such as a Bitcoin. But you can use it for anything. But the thing is it's using up so much power. Like, everyone's moving to Iceland to host their Bitcoin blockchain processes. There's huge computer systems there because power is so cheap there. They've got loads of fjords and stuff.
Really?
Yeah, so it's like something like I don't know, 20-30% of all of Iceland's power is going into producing blockchain.
Is that why Assange moved over there then?
Assange is in the embassy.
Yeah, but he, for a while, he based WikiLeaks out of Iceland.
Oh,
didn't
yeah,
he?
I don't know. I'm not sure if it was because of Bitcoin. I think it was because of privacy law.
Right.
Well, I look forward to learning more facts about this in the next season of Mr. Robot.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's in Mr. Robot, Narcos, Breaking Bad, Ozarks,
they're all
anything.
Documentaries, right?
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. That's the problem with millennials, man. It's just sort of like it's just blended fake news. It's just blended Ozarks with the real news.
Yeah. Yeah, what's real?
It's all fake news. It's fake news.
The other thing I'd like to say about Bitcoin is I really hope it crashes very soon, because I failed to get on the train and I just want to see everyone that invested lose some money.
That's a nice note to end on.
That's a nice sort of positive note. There are actually some people we know who actually made an absolute killing, and so good on them. Well, listen,
thanks,
Billy J.D. Porter, thank you so much. For coming. Just so people can check you out, what's your Twitter handle and your Instagram handle?
It's at Billy JD Porter.
Yeah.
Billy with an IE.
Nice. And the new series, can you tell us anything about it at all?
It doesn't exist yet.
Oh,
but
good.
It'll be good.
So it's sort of just like, it's quantum. It exists in your mind, but it's not actually existing.
It semi-exists. It's not good. Finished.
But the most recent thing you can check out is the Channel
Sound
4
and Vision,
series,
yes.
Right. Well, listen, thank you so much. It would be really, really helpful to the podcast if you guys can subscribe, rate and review the podcast, tell people about it. We will be back soon. Thanks so much for listening.